I have read several things, read a lot of Preston stuff and Dawson and different things. I have not had many experiences of discussing this with people who believe it, and that's certainly a handicap. And I've not read a whole lot of the stuff refuting it. That probably has some pros and cons for what I'll be doing. But we're going to look at, especially Matthew 24, and also just the idea of the coming of the Lord and some things like that. But I want to start out with what I see as just a very big problem with what I have read and seen and what they do. And that is, they use this methodology all the time. Don Preston does constantly in the stuff I've read of his, and Dawson does as well, where they will line two passages up, and they'll say, now, you've got all these parallels in these passages, and therefore they're talking about the same thing. And if this passage is talking about the same thing as this passage, and this passage is talking about the same thing as that passage, then these two are talking about the same thing, and they just line that up on and on. And actually, there's not much controls on that at all. They will take maybe one passage and find parallels in a whole book and claim that it's parallel. When you start looking at the parallels, it's a lot like when brethren do chiasms in one thing or another. There are some chiasms in the Bible, but wow, some of the commentators find them in places where you look at their chiasm and it's like, yeah, that's really good. And then you actually start matching up with the passage and it's not at all what the passage is saying. I think that's what you see in a lot of this kind of thing as well. There's just a lot of improper parallels. You would expect that God is going to do a lot of the same sorts of things in similar ways. All of God's judgments, for example, are a lot alike. You know, if I found you a judgment of God and I said, now here's a judgment where God's punishing wicked people and he's blessing righteous people. Now here's another one where he's punishing wicked people and blessing righteous people. They must be talking about the same judgment. Well, no, all of God's judgments do that. And a lot of the parallels they find are parallel because God does similar things in varying situations. God does not change. People don't change a lot. So if you find one judgment of God, it's probably going to look a whole lot like another judgment of God. Or if you find one coming of the Lord, it's probably going to be a whole lot like another coming of the Lord. So I sat down one day and did a little bit of, high-powered research and came to the conclusion that I can answer the very controversial question about the identity of Babylon in Revelation 17 and 18. You know, some brethren are convinced that it's Jerusalem and some people are convinced that it's Rome. But what I found after looking carefully at all the parallels is that Babylon in Revelation 17 and 18 is the city of Tyre. And you start looking at the parallels, consider what's said about Tyre, especially in Isaiah and Ezekiel, and a little bit in Zephaniah and Zechariah. It's incredible. In Isaiah 23, Tyre is a harlot. Ezekiel 27 presents her as sitting by the waters. And if you remember the context in Revelation 17, she was sitting on many waters, Babylon was. She was clothed with jewels in Ezekiel 28. So was Babylon in Revelation 17. Many nations would come against her, and the nations turned against Babylon. There were many iniquities that Tyre had and that Babylon had. There's some arrogant I am statements in the passages about Tyre in Ezekiel 27 and 28, just like there was about Babylon in Revelation 18. She would fall in one day. That's what he says in both Ezekiel 26 and in Revelation 18. She would be burned by fire. You see that even in Amos's passage about Tyre, as well as Ezekiel and Zechariah. She had made the kings rich. Her fall was lamented by those around her. And I'll tell you, if you look up my parallels, I didn't go ahead and put the passages in Revelation 17 and 18. You can find those. You probably already know them. But you go back and look at my parallels. They're good ones. They're not like some of the ones that you find in some of Preston's stuff. The kings were afraid at her fall. as they were standing at a distance fearfully in Revelation. There is an elaborate description of all the merchandise that Tyre traded in Ezekiel chapter 27, verses 12 to 25. And it's amazing. Many specific parallels with the passage in Revelation 18, verses 12 and 13, where he lists all the different merchandise that Babylon was trading. So many of them are identical. Now, if you've got that much identity, how could it not be the same city? They wore purple. The sailors were appalled at Tyre's fall and at Babylon's fall. There's the statement, who is like Tyre? Who is like Babylon? The ships wailed about her fall. She was never to be found again. Look at the end of Revelation 18. Babylon, the sound was never found in her anymore, and so forth. She became silent. If parallels could prove identity, then I think I proved this one. Babylon's Tyre. Of course, nobody believes that, and nobody could believe it historically when you look at the insignificance of Tyre in the first century. But I think I've got every bit as good a case as they have in a lot of their parallels. Well, they will go through and they'll try to parallel Matthew 24 with 1 Thessalonians 4 or parallel Revelation with Isaiah and different things and try to say, well, if this is talking about this, then so is this and then so is that. And I think that's a very important point in just dealing with the methodology of what I've been reading. If we're going to understand anything, we need to study the book in its context. We need to see what's being said in the context, not see what can we make out of this, not immediately run to other passages and, well, but this is kind of like this. It reminds me of immature Bible students who use a lot of concordance and center column references, and they're always saying, well, now this is kind of like this passage, isn't it? Well, there's probably some parallel wording, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that other passage is talking about the same thing, or in some cases is even particularly helpful in understanding the meaning. I think first we understand the meaning and the context, and then we go on from there. So, think about that. You can draw some of your own parallels. You can see some of the same things. I just sat down with my Bible one day and worked on that for a little while. And there's plenty of those. I want us to look at Matthew 24 and 25 a little bit. And particularly Matthew 24. I've studied Matthew 24 for a long time. And I realize that brethren differ on their convictions about Matthew 24. Probably not all of you will agree with me. Hear me out and see what you think. In the context of Matthew, there are five major sermons. They all end in the same way, so I think Matthew had that in mind. And this is the last of those in Matthew 23 to 25, really. Jesus concluded the woe part of his sermon in Matthew 23 with a scathing rebuke of the people of Israel. And he said they'd constantly killed the righteous men that God had sent to them, and that he would make this generation pay for the innocent blood that they had shed. And he says in verse 38 of chapter 23, behold, your house is being left to you desolate. Reminds you of what you see in Ezekiel, where God left his dwelling place among the people. When Jesus said, God, your house has left you desolate, I believe the idea is there was no occupant. God had left because they were not faithful to him. And so, when the disciples point out the temple buildings that they are leaving, and they are so impressed by them, it's kind of like they have tourist awe over the, look at the magnificence of this. Look at the glory of the temple. It was such a beautiful building, and it was a magnificent structure, a series of impressive buildings. It contained about a sixth of the land area in Jerusalem. They found massive stones. No wonder the disciples were impressed. And Jesus, in the context, I'll just throw this in. I've got this in the notes as well. But I believe there's a point Jesus is making in the context in Mark and Luke. And I think a lot of people haven't thought about this. Sometimes chapter divisions mess us up. But particularly in Luke, you see Jesus condemning the scribes for devouring widows' houses. And then he gives an example of a widow they had exploited. A widow who, poor lady, she gave everything she had to live on while the rich were going along happily putting in out of their abundance. Now, some people have tried to use this as an example for our giving, though I know of no one who really believes we ought to put in everything we have to live on. We use it as an example and then we take it back. But I don't think it's an example for us. I don't really think it's a criticism of the woman particularly, but it's a criticism of the scribes and of the system that was exploiting her, causing her to give her last cent. And for what? Well, in Luke's gospel, right after he talks about that, in Luke chapter 21, and in verse 5, and when while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, these things are going to be torn down. It was adorned with votive gifts. In other words, people were paying a lot of money to make this temple so beautiful. And Jesus says, you see the waste in all this? You know, they've been exploiting these widows, and for what? For a structure that's about to be totally demolished. And the disciples, of course, are shocked. They've been looking at the temple. They think it's beautiful. It's obviously central in the worship of God. And they ask him a series of questions. I honestly don't know what the disciples meant by their questions. I really don't think it matters. Jesus certainly was not above answering questions the way he wanted to. I remember years ago hearing W.L. Wharton preach from Luke 13 about revising the question. Jesus was asked, are there many or few that are going to be saved? And he doesn't bother to answer that. He just says, you need to be one of the ones. You strive to enter in. And there are plenty of times when Jesus will get asked one thing and he will answer his own way. He will answer according to the need of the person. Think about what he said in response to Nicodemus, what he said in response to the woman at the well. So I believe whatever they were asking, Jesus answers them his own way. And he begins to speak about the various things that were going to happen in connection with the destruction of the temple in AD 70. He talks about how before that time would come, there were going to be various things that were very traumatic in the world. There were going to be all these deceivers. Because in those turbulent times before the destruction of Jerusalem, there were a lot of deceivers. He says there's going to be a lot of wars and natural disasters. And a lot of just very troubling and difficult things. But he's saying these things are all going to happen. And those are not really signs of the temple's destruction. These are some things that are going to happen in almost any period of time. And he doesn't want them to be overly troubled or overly worried about those things. It's ironic that these things that were not the signs of the end of Jerusalem are taken today as the signs of the end of the world or of the rapture or something like that. And then he talks about the things that would directly affect the Christians. It's interesting that when Jesus answers questions, even like this, his answer is practical. He deals with things not just on a speculative basis, but he talks about some things that they need to think about. In verse 9, then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many because lawlessness is increased. Most people's love will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. He talks about how the Christians were going to be target of persecutions, and some would apostatize completely and betray their fellow believers, and some would succumb to the false teachings, and that would destroy their faith, and some would cool off and become useless to the kingdom. Various bad reactions that some of the disciples were going to have because of the difficult times, because of the persecution. Mark and Luke talk about how this would be an opportunity, though, for them to testify about their faith. You know, even in difficult times, even when there's persecution, it's going to lead to an opportunity before kings and governors and others to be able to speak and proclaim the name of the Lord. And what they needed to do, endure to the end. It doesn't matter so much about what they know about timing. It matters that they stick it out and they faithfully live for and proclaim Christ. And he says, despite the persecution, this worldwide mission must go on. That the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. And we understand from several passages that the gospel was fully preached in the world in that generation. And then he tells them in verse 15, I'm in Matthew 24, therefore when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Now, I don't know for sure what the abomination of desolation was. I know that that was spoken of in Daniel in a couple of different passages. That phrase is used in Daniel 8 or Daniel 11 for what would happen with Antioch's Epiphanes, but also used, I think, in Daniel 9 in this context for some horrible desecrating thing that was going to happen in the temple. And I believe Jesus is probably the one saying, let the reader understand. That is, let the reader of Daniel be wise and discerning. And when you see this horrible desecration in the temple, then do the counterintuitive thing. Normally, when you saw some trouble brewing, you would flee within the walls of the city for protection. But what Jesus said was to flee away from the city to the mountain, because there was going to be a horrible disaster occur in the city. Luke explains it as when you see Jerusalem compassed by armies. I'm assuming Jesus said both things in the course of what he said. He's giving them various ways that they'll be able to tell. And probably there were some times when the Romans came in those last few months and then apparently once or twice relaxed the siege and made it possible for people to escape. He says you need to get out. You need to flee to the mountains. And you need to do that urgently. He says, whoever's on the housetop must not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever's in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. You know, it's so urgent that you flee. Your cloak could be handy for the flight, but don't go back in to get it. Get out. You can't loiter. You can't stick around because the destruction is coming. And he says, you know, it'll be bad if you've got small children or you're with child. It'd be bad if it's on the winter. Pray that it not be in the winter. The weather would not be good. Be harder to ford some of the streams, perhaps, and things like that. Pray that it not be on the Sabbath. I'm not sure whether he's saying because the city walls would be closed, the doors would be closed, the gates, or whether he's saying you wouldn't be able to buy supplies, or maybe even that fanatical Jews might persecute you. But you need to get out and you need to go to the mountains because there's going to be this terrible tribulation. It's a tribulation worst ever. Now, you know, the Bible uses a lot of those kind of terminology. You know, we say that. Isn't this the worst ever? This is the best ever. Doesn't necessarily mean that we're logically trying to compare all of them and saying this is absolutely the worst. But he's saying it's just going to be a terrible, horrible tribulation. And really only by the grace of God was the tribulation cut short, or even the Christians would not have been spared. In those turbulent times, imposters take advantage of the trauma and of the difficulty. And they would come, false Christs, here, there, and yonder. And they would display signs and wonders, and they would try to deceive the Christians. And what Jesus says is, don't be deceived by these pretenders, by these charlatans that come in troubled times and try to mislead you. He says in verse 27, for just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. I think what he's saying there is that when the Son of Man returns, somebody won't have to tell you, go there, or go here. You know, the real coming of the Lord won't be like these claims of the imposters, but it'll be like lightning flashing across the sky. I suspect he's talking about there, even the second coming, and how that will be so obvious. Though you could take that, perhaps as the coming and destruction on Jerusalem, but I think it's probably better to say, when I really come back, everybody will know. And then he says something kind of cryptic, proverbial in 28. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. He's using that as sort of a proverbial kind of statement. I suppose where most of you live, there's vultures, and you know, when there's roadkill, they come, or when there's a dead animal out in the field, you see the vultures circling. What's dead here? Seems to me like it's the nation of Israel. Their life, the Lord has left. They're dead, and the vultures are coming. The Roman armies, perhaps in this case, coming to destroy the carcass. And then he says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, these terrible things are going to happen. And I don't see how we can avoid the conclusion that 29 to 31 is using judgment language that's frequently used in the prophets to refer to the destruction of a nation. When he says immediately after the tribulation of those days, and when in verse 34 he says this generation won't pass away until all these things take place, I believe that we ought not to see this as the end of the world, but as the end of their world. Their lights were going out, as you see all over the prophets. He talks about the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall. He talks about how the Son of Man will come on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. He'll send forth his angels and gather the elect. There's a very common figure throughout the prophets for the idea of God bringing his people to himself and blessing and protecting them in difficult times. And so he says this is going to be really difficult times, and Jerusalem's going to fall. The sun's going to go out for Jerusalem. The stars are going to fall. And they're going to be destroyed when Jesus comes in judgment upon them. And then he says, you need to learn the lesson from the fig tree. Now, the fig tree, when it puts out leaves, you know that summer's coming. And so when you see these things, I think especially when you see this horrible abomination that occurs in the temple, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, well, you know summer's near. You know that I'm coming. I'm going to be there in judging Jerusalem. And so there's your signs. You need to be as discerning as you would be about the changing of the seasons with the fig putting out leaves. When you see these things happening, you know that the time for the temple to be dismantled is upon you. And then in verse 34, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. There have been plenty of efforts by premillennialists and others to try to redefine this generation or redefine all these things, but I think not very effectively. It seems to me like he's saying that these things up through verse 34 would occur within that generation. He'd been talking about the generation in 23:36. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. And if you look at the use of generation, especially in Matthew, starting with Matthew 1, where he talks about the 14 generations and so forth, you've got the idea of a generation being a period of time from parents to children, that kind of thing. And he says, within this generation, Jerusalem would be destroyed. And he says, you can count on this. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Jeremiah uses that figure a couple of times, that what God's promises are more stable than the universe itself. You can count on his word. Well, here's where the argument comes. And when we start into verse 36, there's a debate about what happens. He says, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. And I believe that the language that is used here, and hear me out, think about what I'm saying, the language that is used starting in verse 36 is very different. It's talking about something different. He has been talking about something that you know when it's going to happen within that generation. And now he says, but nobody knows this. Even Jesus himself is ignorant of when, of that day and hour. Now, these things he was talking about, he knew when it was going to happen, but he says, of that day and hour, no man knows. The angels don't know. I don't even know. Only God knows that. It's really a stretch to think that he was talking about the same thing that he was talking about in verses 32 to 34, where he tells them when it will happen. Now, I know there is what I consider to be a huge dodge on this, and some of you may take this, and so I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm just asking you to think about it. I remember when I first heard this in connection with some premillennialists, and I really found it difficult to take them seriously that they actually believe this. But some people will take this as, well, you know, he knows the year and the month. He just doesn't know the day or the hour. He's trying to say, well, I, you know, but exactly, pinpointing the exact day and hour, now nobody knows that. I just don't think that's a fair explanation for that. You know, sometimes, I feel this way a lot when I'm reading their literature. The question isn't, what can we make something mean? The question isn't, what can we string together and what can we say and how can we come up with a way to get something to say something? The question is, what does God intend for us to get out of it? That's what we're really all trying to do. We're trying to understand what God wants us to understand, and God holds us responsible for that. And I think as you read through this, that he's saying, I don't know when this is going to happen. When you think about the use of that day throughout Matthew and throughout the New Testament, he's not saying, well, I know pretty much the time, I just don't know exactly when. Don't hold me to the day and hour, but I'll get the week right for you. I just don't think that's a fair understanding of that language. You can think about that, and I've given you some passages to consider along that line. And he talks about, he says in verse 37, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Now, he's been talking about something where there'll be all kinds of signs. You know, the armies surrounding Jerusalem, the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, you know by the leafing of the fig tree, to saying this is a period that has no signs. It's just going to be an ordinary period of time. People are going to be doing ordinary stuff. There's not going to be anything out of the ordinary. You know, if you look at Luke 21, it's even more impressive, I think, the contrast. Luke 21:25, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. There will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and on the earth dismay among nations in perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now you contrast that with they're eating and drinking, they're marrying and giving in marriage. You know, two people in the field, two people grinding at the mill. It's a totally different thing. You know, you've got this calm period versus this crisis period. You've got the idea you can tell by these signs, flee to the mountain, with the idea be on the alert. It's like the thief. You know, you don't have any signs. You know, if you're the kind of person who locks your doors, I bet you lock them every time you leave the house, don't you? And why? Do you really believe a thief's going to come every time you leave the house? Well, probably not, but you don't know when it's going to be, so you always leave it locked. You know, when it comes to his second coming, you don't know. It's like a thief, unexpected time, no prior warnings, no sign, everything's going along normally, and suddenly the thief comes. versus everything's in crisis, horrible tribulation, Jerusalem surrounded by armies. You know, everybody's in dismay and fear and panic. He's just talking about two entirely different things. We're gonna talk in a minute about a couple of details here, including what some of these things mean that are a little bit more difficult. But I want you to think about a couple of things here as I try to press my point a little bit. Could you really say that the period of the destruction of Jerusalem was a period like the days of Noah, where they're eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and they didn't know anything about it, and the flood came and took them all away? The period before the destruction of Jerusalem was this period with all the false Christs and all the turbulence and all the crisis and the trauma. It's not like that. Could you really say that the destruction of Jerusalem came like the thief in the night, where there's no warning, where there's nothing that you had no idea it was coming? Well, there were all kinds of signs. Everybody knew trouble was brewing. That's what he's been saying about it, even in what he's been saying here. I think it's just really difficult to hold to the view that this last part of Matthew 24 is talking about the same thing that the first part is. Now let me deal with an objection to that and then deal with what some of these figures mean in Matthew 24. A number of years ago, probably 30 years ago, I worked through this and came up with something that I'd like for you to think about. I didn't really work back through the details. I might, if I really looked back through these carefully, I might disagree with my interpretation of one or another, but the point's the same. There are all kinds of little proverbial kinds of statements that Jesus uses throughout his ministry. One of the objections that's made about taking Matthew 24 with a break is what Kevin showed. Luke 17, you got something that has some things from before the break and after the break. And yet Luke 17 seems to be talking about one thing, whatever that one thing is. And yet he merges language from before and after the break. My point back to that is, that's not surprising, because Jesus uses proverbial type language all through his ministry and applies it in different ways to different settings. This is kind of cool stuff. You might think about some of these just in and of itself, but like the lamp's not to be put under a bushel. You know that from Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount. Don't hide your light. Don't hide your influence. But in Mark 4 and Luke 8, it seems to be that don't hide the word. You know, don't put it under a bushel, because the word is meant to be revealed. And in Luke 11, it seems to be saying something like, the evidence for me is so plain that it can't be hidden. Or what about the slave's not greater than his master? If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. If I washed the disciples' feet, you ought to wash their feet. You'll never be better than your blind guide. If the blind follow the blind, they'll both fall in the ditch. Totally different contexts that proverb applies to. It's not uncommon for Jesus to use proverbial statements in different ways. And I've got a lot of them in your outline. You can look through those and think about them. I think that that's what happens in Luke 17. A little bit later, we'll look at Luke 17, and I'll tell you what I think that applies to and how you can understand some of those proverbs that are from the opposite side of Matthew 24. But come back to Matthew 24 then. Jesus is saying nobody knows when this is going to happen, that it's going to come at an ordinary period when normal events are occurring. And the passage that probably gives people the biggest trouble is verses 40 and 41. Then there will be two men in the field, one will be taken, one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one will be left. What does he mean by that? Well, I don't think he means the destruction of Jerusalem. Because as far as I know, the Romans didn't come in and see two people in the field and say, I want you and not you. That wasn't how that worked. So I didn't really fit that. Now, people have often used this for the idea of the secret rapture concept. And just in and of itself, you might see why somebody would get that. But I think in the context, it's just saying the fate will be extremely different of two people who are externally similar when God's sudden judgment comes. That the judgment when Jesus returns will separate people who were doing the very same job at the same factory. And one of them would be taken to be with the Lord, and the other left to be destruction, or perhaps he means it the other way. One will be taken to destruction, and the other one will be left in security. I can see it both ways. I'm not really sure which it is. But the point is, there's going to be division. Some will be punished, and some will be secure when Jesus comes back and when the judgment comes. He'll be talking about that later on in Matthew 25, where he says everybody will be divided sheep from the goats. And yet there are people who in their lives thought of themselves as being very similar. So he's just saying that when Jesus comes back, people are going to be divided into two camps, and they may be people who you would have thought of as being a lot alike externally in this world. And then he says it's going to be like the thief in the night. You have got to be prepared. You've got to be prepared at every moment. You never know when he's going to come. And he talks in verse 45, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master will put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave said in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and begins to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, well, he's going to be in trouble. If he expects the master to delay, and the master comes back sooner than he was expecting, and one of the things you see in this is that Jesus, even as he's talking about eschatology, he's dealing with practical Christian living. That's one of the things I don't see in these writings. I don't know if they deal with that in other stuff or not, but they don't look at anything about what the passages mean for us. What this means is you treat people right, you don't know when Jesus is going to come back. And if you think he's going to delay, he may come back sooner than you expect. And then he turns around and tells about the 10 virgins, he may come back later than you expect. You don't know when he's going to come. You need to always be prepared. And spiritual preparation is something you cannot borrow. You need to be ready when he returns. He talks about the parable of the talents. He talks about the judgment scene. But in all of these, he's talking about the kind of life we've lived, the kind of preparation we've made, being ready for the Lord by our life when he comes back. Now, for the hyper-preterist, they have no problem with Matthew 25. That's the destruction of Jerusalem too. I don't think most people here would believe that. I think generally speaking, brethren who take Matthew 24 as all referring to the destruction of Jerusalem are willing to see 25 as being the end of the world. But really, they've got a pretty good case. Because look at, say, 24:42. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. Verse 44, for this reason you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Look at that in comparison with 25:13. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. The language similarity is much greater from 36 on, and making the break at 36, than it is trying to make the break between chapter 24 and 25. As I say, for the hyper-preterist, he takes all of that, as he does all end-time passages, as referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. Now let's come back to Luke 17 for a minute. I may drop a few more of you agreeing with me when we come to Luke 17. But again, hear me out on this. I really believe, and I may come to other conclusions, but so far in my approach, I really believe that the destruction of Jerusalem has been slightly overdrawn in our interpretation of the Bible. Years and years ago, I was probably a teenager. I read The Holy Spirit and the Work of Redemption, or whatever that was, by Franklin Camp. And man, he sees the destruction of Jerusalem just about everywhere that some of these guys do. And it was really persuasive. I was like, wow. And then, you know, it's one of those things that when you first read something, especially when you're a teenager, it sounds pretty good. And then you start thinking about it and looking at it and looking at the context, and it doesn't sound that good. Luke 17 is a passage that's often been taken as the destruction of Jerusalem. I think it's better taken as referring to the second coming. When he says in verse 22 of Luke 17, the days will come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man and you will not see it. They will say to you, look there, look here, do not go away and do not run after them, for just like the lightning when it flashes out of one part of the sky and shines to the other part of the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And just as it happened in the days of Noah, so it will also be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, they were being given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It was the same as happened in the days of Lot. They were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. Ordinary time. Not destruction of Jerusalem time. But on that day, Lot went out from Sodom. It rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. And then we've got the problem verse. On that day, the one who's on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. And likewise, the one who's in the field must not turn back. Now that's from the part of the passage in Matthew 24 that's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And is saying, don't go into your house and get stuff because you need to flee urgently. But I don't think that's how he's using that proverbial language here. I think he's saying, if you're going to be ready for the Lord's return, you can't be attached to stuff in this life. He goes on in the next verse to say, remember Lot's wife. What was Lot's wife's problem? Curiosity? No. Her problem is she was longing for Sodom. It wasn't just she'd never seen fire and brimstone before and she was wanted to see what it looked like. She was longing to be in Sodom. She looked back with that mentality. He said, you need to remember her because you can't have that kind of mentality. You can't have this sort of attachment to earthly things. You can't cling on to what you have in terms of this world's goods and be ready for the second coming. On that day, the one who's on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. And likewise, the one who's in the field must not turn back. I think he's saying, if you're going to be ready for the Lord's return, you can't be looking back. And you can't be going down and trying to carry out all the stuff in your house. You got to remember Lot's wife and look to the Lord. Look at what he says in the next verse. Whoever seeks to keep his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will preserve it. In the context, it seems to me that he's using this as an illustration, trying to keep your life. Trying to continue with your attachment to the stuff in this world. So I think this is an example of another proverbial kind of statement that Jesus is using in a different context in Luke 17. In verse 34, he says, I tell you on that night, there will be two in one bed. One will be taken and the other will be left. There'll be two women grinding at the same place. One will be taken, the other will be left. And answering, they said to him, where, Lord? And he said to them, where the body is, there also the vultures will be gathered. Of course, that's the other thing that is from the earlier part of Matthew 24. I don't think that's a problem at all. That's clearly a proverbial statement saying, whenever the people are dead, the vultures come. Here you've got those who are spiritually dead, and the vultures are going to destroy them. So you need to be alive by losing your life. To find it when Jesus returns. So in my judgment, Luke 17 is talking about the second coming. It's talking about the end of the world. And it's not a problem that it uses some language from the earlier part of Matthew 24 because it's using those in proverbial type statements. Let's look for a minute at some of the other passages that talk about the second coming. One of the big ideas of these guys is that all the coming of the Lord passages are talking about the same thing. Well, there's plenty of coming of the Lord passages that aren't talking about even their second coming, even their coming and destruction on Jerusalem. But Philippians 4:5, the Lord is at hand. I believe he's talking about the Lord is at hand, he's near. Not temporally, but spatially, he's close to you. Romans 13, our salvation is nearer than when we first believe. I think it is for all of us. I don't think that's a sign necessarily that the Lord's going to return tomorrow or the next day, but we're going to meet the Lord in judgment sooner now than we were yesterday. I don't see a problem with taking it that way. James chapter 5 is a bit more challenging, but I suspect that he's using the term the coming of the Lord just to mean God's coming in blessing and judgment. He says, James 5, 5, you've lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You've fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You've condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too be patient, strengthen your heart, for the coming of the Lord is near. I think he's just saying the Lord's going to come in judgment of your oppressors. He's going to come to give you relief. The Lord comes all the time throughout the Bible, not a physical coming, but a coming to give relief to his persecuted people and to judge the wicked. You've got some of the passages that Kevin's got a much better, more extensive approach on Mello than what I have here. You've got 1 John 2, it's the last hour. I think he may just mean it's a critical time. Clearly, any way you cut it, there have been plenty of hours after when John wrote 1 John 2. Perhaps 1 Peter 4 is the hardest passage for me. Some of you may have a better idea than I do. It could be it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem when he says the end of all things is near. I've wondered if he's saying that we're always near the end. We're always just a step away from Jesus coming back. You can think about that. I want to close by just making a few observations. One thing is we need to carefully study. You know, some errors seem like they're not very serious, but they cause us trouble later on. We need to know the best we can what's right. Errors about Matthew 24, the book of Revelation, even errors like in Hebrews 8:13. We need to know what the passages mean. We need to study them in context. You know, some errors may seem like they don't have consequences, but later on they may lead to false doctrines. We need to study in context. This idea of using constant text comparisons is not as helpful as first really studying the Bible. And then we need to step back and see what's there. Sometimes we get tunnel vision. Again, our question is, what did the Lord intend for us to understand? Not what can we make out of this? So step back and look at it and study it and think about it. What is the Lord really trying to communicate? Not what debates better even. And then I think our heart is important in our life. We're going to be more vulnerable to these errors when we're in the darkness. And when we have pride, when we're hard-hearted, there's a number of passages I put in that point. You can look at those and think about those. But that may be especially true when some really good, knowledgeable men fall into error. There may be more behind this than just a misunderstanding. And especially when you see things like this that are so difficult to imagine how somebody could believe. And we need balanced study. This idea of studying just one side of a picture is not a good thing. The idea of studying just for polemic purposes but not seeing the practical value of Scripture is not good. We need to study the Bible in context, see what it's really saying to us. And then finally, if we accept the hyper-preterist view, most of the New Testament doesn't really apply to us. You know, who can believe that? I think, you know, when I've read this and studied it, I realize I haven't talked to many people who believe it. But I really think it's a very wrong system, a wrong doctrine. And I think if we'll just keep studying the Bible and really know the truth, it will be relatively easy for us to understand that. I appreciate a lot your letting me talk. We'll take a break, I guess. Jim can tell us that, and then we'll come back and talk about some questions.